Ada Limon is the author of three previous collections of poems, Lucky Wreck, This Big Fake World, and Sharks in the Rivers. Her poetry has appeared in The New Yorker, The New York Times, American Poetry Review, Gulf Coast Poetry Daily, and American Life in Poetry, among many others. This is her fourth book, Bright Dead Things. It is a finalist in the National Book Award. Ada, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And congratulations on your new book, Bright Dead Things, put out by Milkweed Editions, your second book with Milkweed. And this one was a nominee for the National Book Award for Poetry of her 2015. Now, that must have been exciting.
It was exciting. I'm still recovering. I'm still vibrating from it. It's been quite insane and wonderful.
This is your fourth book. And one of the interesting things about your bio that I just have to ask about is here you, I guess you went to NYU. That's where you got your MFA. Is that right, NYU?
Yeah, yes. That's correct.
Yeah. Studied with some great poets, Philip Levine, Sharon Olds, just to name a few. Mm-hmm. You know, you had no books, and then suddenly you come out with two books of poems in 1 year. How does that happen?
Yes. Well, I guess like a lot of poets who finish up their MFA, then you kind of struggle with getting your poems out there. As you know, it's always sort of if you're writing fiction or nonfiction, whatever it is, you're always just trying to, you know, keep at it, right? You keep your nose down and you just get the work done. And I was sending out a lot, and I had two manuscripts that I was working on. And at the time, I was working for Martha Stewart, and the nice thing about having an office job in Manhattan was that I had access to copiers and printers, so I could print out my manuscripts and send them out. This is before everything was done by emails and PDFs. So my first book got accepted, and of course, couldn't believe it, was completely in awe, and it absolutely changed my life. And then 6 months later, before the first book had even come out, I got a phone call about the second book. And I actually thought they were talking about the first book, and I thought, oh, no, I must have forgotten to withdraw from another contest. So I thought, oh, shoot, you know, I'm going to have to tell them, oh, it's actually already being published, already got picked up. And they said, oh, no, we're talking about this big fake world. And so within 6 months, I had both manuscripts picked up, and I couldn't believe it. Wow. I mean, I'd been sending out for 5 years. So I always tell people, you know, it'll happen. It'll happen.
Wow, that is an amazing story. I mean, did they come out actually physically in the same year? Did you get the boxes in the same year?
I got them within 6 months of each other, not actually the same year, because I got the boxes for Lucky Wreck in March, and then it took a little longer for This Big Fake World to come out, so it came out probably 7 months after that, or it was January of the next year.
Right, right. So, well, yeah, but that's calendar year, but I mean, it was within a year, which is just an amazing experience.
Within a year, yeah. I went from a poet who had no books out, and some publications, like I had, you know, some decent publications, but nothing huge, to having two full-length books, not even a chapbook, two full-length books in my hand. It was pretty wild.
Yeah. I guess what poets know is when you get a book, the work begins. You don't just get a book and then, you know, you have to work it. And what was it like having two books to promote? Did you have to, like, double the readings and double the all the promotion work?
Yeah, you know, book promotion is such a huge part of this, right? I mean, in this world, and especially with poetry, you know, you're on presses that are great and they do what they can to support you, but there's not a lot of funding there. So if you're going to read somewhere, you're hoping that maybe they'd at least pay for your gas money, right? So, yeah, you know, I put in a lot of money, of my own money, to do Lucky Wreck. And it was a little harder for me to scrape together money for the second book. So to this day, sometimes I still regret not having sort of saved up enough of my own funds to have promoted this big, big world the way that I would have wanted to. It's hard for poets because you're always sort of, you know, if you want to fly somewhere and someone says, oh, come to read here in Seattle at this bookstore, they'd love to have you, and you'd love to go, but if you're living in New York, as I was at the time,
right,
you know, that's a $600 plane ticket. So, yeah, it was a struggle to promote them both, but I, you know, I hope I did them justice.
Yeah, and I think that there's a learning curve for new poets. I mean, some new poets immediately know how to do it, and they're going to thousands of readings and selling all kinds of copies. But otherwise, there's a learning curve. But, you know, at first, you're unsure about it. You don't want to assert yourself too much because it might seem too much like self-promotion, and that's always seemed like a bad thing. Mm-hmm. But then after a while, you kind of get better and better and better at it. Did you find yourself getting better at it? And did you carry, metaphorically, I guess, a bunch of books in the trunk of your car?
Yeah, metaphorically and physically. Yeah, I did. I did have a hard time promoting myself at first because it feels like, well, you know, as a writer, a lot of what we do is spend time alone, staring out the window, alone with our thoughts. And on some levels, we're introverts. And so we kind of have to turn that on its side and become the extrovert. You have to force the extrovert out of you in order to promote your own work. And then you have to get up there and read poems that you wrote in a very personal space, right? And be raw and emotional and bare in front of an audience. So it was an extreme learning curve. I learned a lot from watching the poet Jimmy Santiago Baca. I traveled with him a little while when I was first starting out and did a couple radio shows with him and sort of watched how he worked, and he was so good at it. And he was such a natural, he was so generous with his time. Mm-hmm. It never felt like self-promotion when he did it. It always felt like he was just trying to start a conversation. And so I think in working with him, I hope I learned a lot.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah,
yeah,
I think, you know, with my first novel, I thought I was going to, you know, I was published by Simon & Schuster. So I thought, wow, I'm going to take this money. I'm going to go to live in Buenos Aires for a year. And I did. And so my book sold nothing. But yeah, I mean, and as the years, you know, went on, I started to get a little bit better at it. You write this idea in your blog, which I think is really a wonderful point, and you say that when women poets write about their feelings, it's much different than when men poets write about their feelings, because with men, if they write about their feelings, they're thought of as being brave, but if women write about their feelings, they're thought of, you know, like they're sharing too much, or they're being whiny, or however you put it. But it was really a brilliant observation about the difference, and I'm wondering if you found that's also the case when it comes to promoting our work. Is it easier for men to promote their work? Does that double standard exist, do you think?
You know, I do think it exists. And I think it's also something that we are responsible for on some levels. It's the same way that I feel like women often apologize too much, right?
Right.
Or there's that sort of level where we're always, oh, you know, I wrote this, but I don't know, it's not so good, or, you know. And I think in watching this happen throughout the many readings I've done so far in my life and watching men get up there, they never apologize. You know, they read what they're going to read, and they have this wonderful way of just of getting through it and really presenting their work in a way that's authentic. So I've actually tried to learn from the men that I've seen do that. And I think it's true that oftentimes when women are writing something that's very emotional or that deals with something that might be a domestic issue, right? Sometimes it can be dismissed as easy for us because it's sort of our world.
Oh, that's interesting.
And I don't think it is. It's and I see this happen sometimes when you see a man get up and read sort of beautiful poems about fatherhood. And everyone will be, oh, that was so brave. Oh, I've never heard this. Oh, you know. And then a woman gets up and reads about motherhood. And it doesn't quite get the same reception. There's a certain level of like, well, that's your world that you exist in. So, of course, you write about that.
Right.
And so that's something that I've definitely seen and hope that we overcome as we continue as writers.
I'm talking to Ada Limón, whose new book just came out very recently, Bright Dead Things, a National Book Award finalist. And I have one more question I wanted to ask you. Like I said, you went to NYU, which is just a fantastic MFA, and Philip Levine, of course, taught there. And I'm from Fresno. And
oh, wonderful.
Yeah. And when I was the visiting writer at Fresno State, I was living in Philip Levine's house while he was in New York. at NYU. Oh, it was fantastic. It was great. It was wonderful. Used to write in his office every day. But I think of him as a great teacher. I mean, he's known among poets for being a fantastic, very direct and honest teacher. I've never met Sharon Olds, and I think also there's, you know, many other great poets that have taught at NYU. And I'm wondering if there's something you could remember from any one of your teachers, something they said to you that just kind of clicked and you brought it with you wherever you went and you share it even with other writers. Is there something you can remember?
Yeah. And thank you for bringing up Phil Levine, because Sharon Olds and Marie Howe, Mark Doty, I had wonderful, wonderful teachers there. But Philip Levine was my first teacher there. So imagine, first semester,
wow.
I was only 22. I was new to this poetry thing. And here was Phil being direct and
yes.
at times brutal. And it was really, trial by fire. And he taught me, I think, so much. And again, my other teachers were the same, although what I learned from him, I learned so quickly. And one funny story in his class, I had was reading a lot of Kenneth Koch at the time because, of course, we were young in New York, and it was kind of like the New York school was big. And so I thought, I'm going to start writing like Kenneth Koch. And so I was writing these poems that kind of had numbers and lists and sort of sporadic things together. And he kind of looked at it like, this isn't my style. This isn't something I like, right? And the wonderful poet Kazem Ali was in my class as well.
Oh, yeah.
And he said,
he's fantastic.
Yeah, I love him. He's a dear friend. And he says, but Phil, don't you think there's some beautiful lines here? And Phil says, oh, sure, there's some beautiful lines. I just wish she'd put them in a freaking poem.
Oh, my God. You know, I've heard a lot of Philip Levine stories from his students, and that's, I think, one of the best. That's fantastic.
So, of course, he didn't say Frankie.
Right.
The other
yes,
words.
Yes.
But of course, I was devastated.
Right.
but I think about it all the time because it is true. I mean, you can have gorgeous lines, but if they're not all working towards the final thrust and final point of the poem, then it's not going to work.
Yeah.
So I think about that a lot. Yeah.
I wonder if teachers like Philip Levine and before him in fiction writing, I'm a fiction writer. I know you're working on a novel, I believe, but the tradition of Flannery O'Connor and Bernard Malamud and John Berryman in poetry, the tradition of being that direct and being that, you know, if you survive the workshop, you're probably going to be a poet. But if you don't survive, you're just, you know, so what? Poetry isn't going to suffer. I mean, that kind of attitude. I'm wondering if we're losing that kind of attitude with the proliferation of MFA programs and the workshop. I'm wondering if there's a new generation of those kind of professors that would say what Philip Levine said.
Yeah, you know, I wonder about that, too. I teach a lot of online classes, and I do teach some workshops here and there. And I've taught at NYU undergrad and Columbia Graduate School, and I do find that I'm more generous
right.
and tend to sort of try to create a generative, creative space for my students. But I do wonder sometimes, am I being tough enough?
Right.
Am I really speaking the truth? And aren't there times you want to say, this isn't working, you know, throw it away? So I don't know. For me, it's a tough to be that harsh. I think he had the right personality for it.
Right.
And I also think he had that perfect mix of wit and humor with that toughness.
Right.
So it was balanced perfectly. So, I think there are some teachers that are still good at it and still doing it. I definitely don't quite have that sharp edge as he did. And sometimes I wish I could channel it more.
When I was at University of Oregon, that's where I got my MFA. I was, I'd come from Fresno. And so over there, you know, Philip Levine really influenced the English department and the creative writing aspect of it in particular. And then I get there and I'm studying with Garrett Hongo, and Garrett Hongo.
I've heard stories. Yeah.
He's a mean Philip Levine. He doesn't have the wit that comes with it. But great teacher. And so my first time trying to teach, I was brutal. I was brutal. And I made 2-3 students cry. And after that, I just couldn't do it anymore.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a tough thing to balance those. When you're teaching, you really want to be supportive and generous. But then there is a part of you that feels like, well, we learned in this way. That was pretty brutal, right?
Yeah, yeah. Absolutely. I'm talking to Ada Limon. Bright Dead Things is her latest collection of poems. And Ada, you say that this book is your most personal book of poems yet. And I'm quoting you, say, it's raw in a way that I'm not used to. I don't mean unfinished. I mean open. I've read River Sharks, which I think is just a beautiful book. And I unfortunately haven't had the chance to see your other two books. And I do see that this is a different book. But what do you mean by that, that this is your most personal book of poems?
You know, I was really, when I was starting to work on this book, I kept asking myself, what are you scared of? What do you not want to write? And so these poems came out of that conversation I had with myself. I was really trying to get into a headspace where I was allowing myself to write poems that I didn't necessarily believe were poetic, mm-hmm. or the subject wasn't worthy of a poem, etc. So I was really trying to get into a place where I was being as honest with myself as I could be.
Mm.
And so these poems came out of that work. Now, with Sharks in the Rivers, I was very interested in allegory and myth, mm. and the idea of carrying the rivers and the animals throughout that book. And even though I don't think that book is any less true, I think it had a little bit of a distance because in some ways I was kind of myth-making. And in this work, it's just me.
Are these poems less poetic in that sense that there's, I don't know, there's less attention to the artifice or the, mm-hmm. I don't know if I'm asking this question correctly.
No, I think you're right. I think that on some level with this book, I was always trying to say the thing. I think as poets, we do this delicate, intricate dance with the truth. And there's times where the song and the sound and the lyric win above the narrative or right. above the fact. And I was really trying to balance those two and always make sure that I was actually saying the thing. So I was still bowing down to the poem above all, but I also wanted to really be saying how it was and be as truthful as I could with myself.
There was a story that somebody told me. I forget the details of the story, but the story was basically talking about this great Chinese poet who, before he would release his poems into the world, he would go and read it to the lady next door who didn't have any experience. And if she was able to be moved by it, then he knew it was ready. Are these poems more accessible than your earlier work? Not that they were opaque in any way.
I think this is a more accessible book. And I've been getting comfortable with the word accessible. I think, as you know, it can sometimes have a negative connotation. Accessible can mean easy and, you know, perhaps not as smart.
Right, right.
So, but I'm learning to accept the word accessible as also poems that are just talking to people.
Yeah.
And this work for me was really a conversation I was having with the reader and myself. And I was really interested in talking to people. I was really interested in reaching people who aren't necessarily poets. I feel like oftentimes in this world, we write poems for other poets. And that just seems so isolating and kind of a dangerous cycle to be in.
Right.
And I was more interested in writing poems that, you know, would be read by the guy who, you know, works with horses out on the Kentucky farm, or you know, I wasn't necessarily always trying to write for other writers.
One of the wonderful things about dipping into this particular book, Bright Dead Things, there's an intimacy in the sense that the reader can transport herself to where the poet is, and in many cases in Kentucky. And Kentucky plays a really large part of this book thematically, I suppose, if one were to really analyze it. But, you know, certainly in terms of the setting. And you said something earlier that reminded me of what Natalie Diaz said, fantastic poet. When I had her on the show, she was saying that what she does, and this almost sounds like what you said, is she thinks about what is the hardest thing that she could write, the hardest thing, and then she writes it. And I really admire that. But I'm wondering, as you're doing that, especially with this book, and I imagine you're writing these most of these poems in Kentucky. You're no longer in New York. You're no longer in wherever you were before then. That landscape, it must have had an incredible effect on the poems. But I'm wondering if the poems, because they often hurt, had an effect on the landscape.
You know, I think that that's somewhat true. I think, you know, I made the big move to leave New York in 2010, and I originally moved home to Sonoma, California. But my partner has a horse racing video company here in Kentucky. And so I moved with him to here. And at first, I really struggled with it because I was really imagining my life on the West Coast after so many years on the East Coast. So I think there was a sort of a struggle with the landscape going on. It was beautiful and gorgeous and green. We moved here in the spring. It was just stunning. It's a beautiful state. But I also struggled with it. I thought, where's the ocean?
Right. You know,
where's the water? But I think the sort of feeling of being isolated in this really green, gorgeous world made for these really emotional poems, and also sort of a safe place to explore those poems. I was freelancing for the first time, so I wasn't going to an office. I was writing from home. All of my life was revolved around my desk and my walks with my dog and my evenings with my partner. So it was the space and the landscape really did get transformed by the work that I was doing. And I still feel like if we settle down here for good, which we may, this place will always be a creative space for me.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like it.
Yeah, I read somewhere that green is a very creative color, that when you're painting or working on something, that green is supposed to be a color that really inspires creativity. And, you know, it's a very, very green state, and I think that really helps.
Right. And also, it's supposed to be soothing, which, of course, you, as, with your theater background, know why they call the green room the green room.
Right. Exactly. It's where you go to breathe.
Let's talk about State Bird, a poem in this book, which was published by The New Yorker, which in itself must have been an amazing experience to have a poem in The New Yorker.
But thank you.
It starts off, confession, I did not want to live here. And and it is about, we assume, Kentucky because of all the details. But then it just has this beautiful line where it says, I'll concede this, whatever state you are, I'll be that state's bird. It's a really beautiful line, and it's a love poem.
Yeah. There's a great deal of love poems in this book. And I think on some level I was a little scared to write love poems. I was more used to writing longing poems and writing from a place of happiness is also a really tough thing to do. Sometimes, like Natalie Diaz was saying, writing from the thing that scares you the most, sometimes that's joy. And so in this book, writing the poems that were joyful and full of happiness were really hard. Finding a language for joy is more difficult than we think.
Do you read Ross Gay?
I do. He's a dear friend. I adore him. And his work is extraordinary.
And he's one of the poets that gets away with writing about joy.
Yeah. Yeah. But I feel like that's like even how you just said get away with it. Like, isn't that interesting, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Right? Like, oh, because he can write about happiness.
Right.
Well, it's like we don't all have the permission, but we do. And we need to give ourselves that permission.
I totally agree because I am at a point in my life to where I am just celebrating every day, and I don't think my fiction is suffering at all.
Yes, good. I love to hear that.
Ada Limon, would you read us a poem from Bright Dead Things?
Sure, absolutely.
One of these poems won the Pushcart Prize. I love that poem.
Oh, yeah. Would you like to hear that one?
I would love to hear you read that.
Okay. All right. This poem is about the day before the Kentucky Derby, which is the Oaks Day, which is when all the fillies race for the female horses. Mm. It's one of my favorite days. And, of course, when I say it's about that, it's never really about that. How to Triumph Like a Girl. I like the lady horses best, how they make it all look easy, like running 40 miles per hour is as fun as taking a nap or grass. I like their lady horse swagger after winning. Ears up, girls, ears up. But mainly, let's be honest, I like that they're ladies, as if this big, dangerous animal is also a part of me. That somewhere inside the delicate skin of my body, there pumps an 8-pound female horse heart, giant with power, heavy with blood. Don't you want to believe it? Don't you want to lift my shirt and see the huge beating genius machine that thinks, no, it knows, it's going to come in first.
That was Ada Limon, How to Triumph Like a Girl, the Pushcart Prize-winning poem from her new book, Bright Dead Things. Ada, thank you for joining us on Words on a Wire.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.